Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM, this April 26, 2016 edition, episode 87 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks again to Amperson for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is a call-in show, so please prepare those questions and get ready to give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. We have a studio audience of four. And, Guy, we have a special guest. Why don't you tell us who's here?
We do. We have Mark Hanneberg. Some of you know him from Facebook or from the blog. He has edited and created some video featuring my work, and he's here visiting for a few days from his home in Texas. And we'll be going to California and shooting some more video on my forthcoming tour there.
And speaking of video, what's he doing at the moment?
I'm here for support.
He's videoing us right now.
Oh, we're
This is why we have that big-eyed look and we're staring into the camera looking real nervous.
Check out our hair sometime.
So this will be the first ever video production of the radio production.
Right. It's
I'm confused. I don't know what
radio on video.
It's moving up.
It is. All right. Okay.
And by the way, Mark shot video and will be editing it for the trailer for Mike's forthcoming book, Chasing a Different Carrot.
Yeah. If the book ever comes out, there will be a trailer for it. And
maybe the trailer will be ahead of it.
The trailer's probably going to be better than the book itself. But
It's getting the trailer ahead of the horse or something.
Right.
Whatever.
He's doing jokes now about my book. Anyway. So, yeah, if that ever comes out, look forward to that trailer. Mark will be producing that. So, all right, let's get to our guests. We are joined today by environmental writer Sean Prentice. And you can find his work at seanprentice.com. It's P-R-E-N-T-I-S-S. And the first name is Sean, S-E-A-N, seanprentice.com. Winner of the 2015 National Outdoor Book Award for history biography, Sean has lived in most parts of the United States and now occupies New England. Wherever he has lived, writing and the power of stories have been part of his life. Best known as the author of Finding Abby, A Search for Edward Abbey and His Hidden Desert Grave, Sean also co-edited an anthology on the craft of creative nonfiction titled The Far Edges of the Fourth Genre and co-authored Environmental and Nature Writer, A Craft Guide and Anthology. The latter book is scheduled for publication this year from Bloomsbury Press. Sean also publishes magazine articles and is the creative editor for Backcountry Magazine. When he's not writing, traveling, canoeing, mountain biking, or drinking a dark beer, Sean teaches at Norwich University, and he runs the Norwich University Writers Series and the Chameleon Literary Journal. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Sean.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate being here.
Excellent. About 2 months ago, we had Doug Peacock on the program, and then Guy and I were fortunate enough to go and spend an afternoon with him in Tucson and drink a couple dark beers. And it occurred to me that during the interview and subsequently visiting Doug that they don't seem to make guys like Doug Peacock and Ed Abbey anymore. And I was wondering your thoughts about that as you did your research for his book.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I had the chance to interview Peacock a few Octobers ago, and I remember, you know, doing all my research into Peacock, and what you hear so much about is how he's a beer drinker, a foul mouth person, prone to violence, all of those things. So I went out into the desert. We spent 7 hours talking, and I think a couple of the things that really blew me away about Peacock and also I think fits in with Abbey was just not only does Peacock resemble some of those things, and a lot of that comes from Abbey and how he portrayed Peacock in the Monkey Ranch Gang as George Washington Haju, but just Peacock's brilliance to go along with all that. That was the most amazing thing that I discovered when I got to sit out in the desert with him. He just knows everything about the environmental movement and environmental ideas. And I was really, really impressed with his thoughts and his ideas. And then just the final thing, tying it all back to Abbey, is I think a lot of Abbey's friends and Abbey himself, these were just big, larger-than-life, masculine men who, for almost always good, but, you know, sometimes there were some issues. They lived as big, iconic men in the world, which is just always fun to examine from a distance.
Yeah, that goes right back, and perhaps you've already partially answered these questions. In 2009, you set out to track Abbey's life. I'd like to start with two why questions. Why Abbey, and why 20 years after his death in 1989?
Two great questions. Why Abbey? So back in 1994, I was a senior in college. I was a business major, and my plan... Well, I had no plan. I went to college with no direction. I had no idea what I was going to do, and I figured I would stumble somehow into some business. But when I was about to graduate, my best friend House, who is in the book, he brought a book over to my house, and he said, "Read this." And it was Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey. And when I read it, it was the first book that I'd ever read that felt as if it was written for someone just like me. And as I read it, it made me think about the environment in new ways. Actually, I should say, it made me think about the environment. I was not very environmentally active back then. And it also made me think about creative writing in ways, because here was a writer that wrote in ways that my friends and I talked. So that was just like this little germ that or seed that was planted. And over the years, it just slowly grew. So that was why Abbey. He was the first writer that I really connected with. I loved books, but he was the one that felt similar to the world I was living in. And then why 20 years later? I guess the most basic answer was, one is a very pragmatic answer. Once you graduate from grad school in my field, you're supposed to write a book, so I needed a book subject. But then the more maybe hopefully beautiful answer is, I had moved to a city far from the mountains. As you mentioned in your intro, I've lived all over the U.S., but almost always near mountains or deserts. And I moved to the city far from mountains or deserts, and I felt really placeless in that city. And I was trying to figure out what to do. Was this my fault that I need to suck it up and just deal with living in the city? I mean, it seems like most of America, most of the world is now moving towards cities, and maybe it's just me having to figure out how to survive. Or maybe there was something inherently true in this feeling of mine, and I needed to leave the city. So I decided to go on a quest, just like so many of us do, and my quest was to search for Abbey's grave. But it was really a quest to figure out how Abbey could teach me about what home is and where I should make my home. So that's why I chose Abbey, and that's why it took me so long to actually go searching for him, because I needed a real reason to go searching for him.
As you just indicated, as you're writing the book, you turn the magnifying glass on yourself. So why don't you go down that road a little bit more? Tell us how that came about.
Well, again, I guess I could have just done a biography on Abbey, but James Kalin has already done a great job of that. I didn't want to just do a search for Abbey's grave as an adventure narrative. That, to me, felt really shallow. You know, who really cares where Abbey's grave is? it's got to be something more than that. And for me, I was just, you know, one single human trying to figure out what the heck to do with my life. So, you know, I'd talk to a variety of friends, talk to colleagues, tried to figure out how to survive this life in the city, and I kept repeatedly failing. It was my second attempt at city living and my second failure. So I thought, why don't I go to one of my ghost mentors? I'd read all of Abby's works. He'd guided me as a ghost mentor towards writing, but also towards environmental thoughts. So I thought, well, let's go back to this ghost mentor and see his thoughts on home. Because Abby had experienced many of the same things I was experiencing at that time. He had five wives, and a few of them, not all at the same time, he'd marry them and get divorced, or one died on him. But his wives, many of them lived on the East Coast, and Abby would move with them to the city, and he'd feel really, really placeless and escape from the city and race back out west. And he'd sometimes abandon his family, and he really dealt a lot with this idea of place. So I thought, why not turn to this ghost mentor who's taught me so much and just linger in his ideas and use his ideas to reflect back on me. And it was super valuable for me. It taught me so much about place and so much about where my place is. So that was why I turned the focus back on me, mainly just because I needed to figure out what the heck to do with my life.
And so turning that magnifying glass on yourself obviously changed you. And particularly with respect to where you live, city, country, what else? What other changes were manifest as you studied Abby and turned that magnifying glass on yourself?
Well, one of the big things, and I think this ties into exactly what you all do with your radio show, by studying Abby and thinking about the environmental issues that he found so important. So today we're living in a world that's completely different than the world Abby lived in. I mean, he was focusing on stuff like overpopulation, loss of wilderness, and industrialization. And those are all issues we're facing, but now we have that added thing of climate change. And I think what Abby has really helped me see is that climate change needs to be at the top of our list. But I think often, and I don't know why, maybe it's fear, we forget one of the biggest causes of climate change. And I think if Abby were still alive, he'd be writing letters to the editor and pounding the desk and getting in front of microphones and talking about this. But it's been Abby's pet cause his whole life, which was overpopulation issues.
Right.
And I think this is one of the things that Abby has really guided me toward is that climate change is real and it's powerful. But we can't just keep looking for ways to reduce carbon emissions, because if we do that and don't also consider population, then we're going to be fighting one battle while losing another battle. So we reduce carbon emissions but keep increasing population. So that's one big thing that Abby really helped me think about, especially environmentally, is just how we have to complicate our discussion on climate change and see climate change as partly a symptom of our overpopulation crisis.
Right. I know, Sean, you've gone in quite a journey since being a business major in 1994 to writing a book on Abby and thinking about and speaking about and writing about all these issues, population and climate change and other environmental issues. What has been the response to your journey from friends, family, people that have known you and seen you going through this?
Well, probably the most exciting response is that I would have considered myself a writer since about 2002 when I went to grad school. Now, mind you, I was a pretty terrible writer, but I would have still called myself a writer. But from 2002 to 2015, when the book came out, almost no one read any of my stuff. So the only things that, you know, my friends or family would actually read for the most part was magazine stuff. Right. And it was really fun to have a book out and have both of my parents read the entire book and talk to me about it, or to have my brother and sister read it or friends read it. And for the first time, really get to talk to them about writing ideas, Abby, environmental ideas. So having that book out and it kind of puts you in a different place and people pay more attention to you, which is, you know, tons of fun. But it's just been so cool to have people read my work and then talk to me about it, whether they love it or like it or dislike it. It's just fun to have those conversations. And it just, you know, brings up so many new ideas.
That's a great outcome. Over a 2-year period, you traveled around the southwestern United States. You interviewed Abby's friends. You visited his favorite haunts, searched for his hidden grave. But why? I mean, what's the point of finding Abby? One of the outcomes is you have these great conversations, but I'm guessing you didn't have that in mind when you were writing it.
Well, when I started writing it, I wish I could say I knew exactly how the book was going to progress, but a lot of it was, let's go searching for his grave and see what comes out of it at the end. And then as I got deeper and deeper into it, I started realizing that I'm on this quest. And so I teach literature at my university, at Norwich University. And one of the things we talk about a lot when we talk about literature is that almost every book is a quest story. And that's where a person goes out in search of something, and they run into trials along the way. But what they realize is what they've started searching for is not what they really find in the end. So a quest has an expected destination, and then it has a real destination. And as I was doing my very own quest, and I wouldn't have called it a quest when I was on it, I would have just said, I'm just researching Abby and seeing what the heck I can figure out and searching for his grave. But what I realized again was I started out looking for Abby's grave, and what I really ended up looking for was a mentor to teach me how to live my life, how to decide where to live my life, how to figure out what's most important. So, and what Abby taught me was writings, his journals, his friends, was that, number one, home is vitally important. I watched or read and researched about how Abby spent so much of his life searching for home and not finding it. And then only once he refused to have a dualistic life, one that was split between some eastern city and some western location, once he committed fully to the west, only then was he able to find home. And then the other thing was, you know, this idea of overpopulation, which we talked about, or preservation of wild lands. That's another big thing that Abby taught me. And then Abby also taught me tons about community. We were talking about Peacock to start out, or Loeffler, Jack Loeffler, or David Peterson, or Ken Flight, the men I interviewed. And Abby's community was so tight and so powerful that 20 years later when I was interviewing them, they would still tear up about memories. They would still, you know, strongly defend his stances and his views and his ideas. And those were some of the really big things that I got out of this journey at the end, and it helped me figure out that I needed to quit my job, and I had a great job, and sell my house and move to New England, which is not where I ever expected to end up, but it's been a perfect move here to northern Vermont. It's been really wonderful.
Yeah, that seems to be going around, quitting your job and moving somewhere else. This guy and I caught that bug, and
Hey, I recommend it to everyone. Quit your job. Move somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And find community and find a home. Those words run deep with me as well, and I know they run with Guy. Those are important things that when I was in college, I never thought about those things. You know, I thought about getting a job and getting, you know, saving some money and buying a home and a car and starting a family. And, you know, if you would have said those words to me then, I would have looked at you like I probably did most people that were living on the edge of mainstream society. I would have just thought you were nuts. And it was so far from my world and anything I had ever been taught or indoctrinated into that it just didn't seem important. And after living in neighborhoods my whole life, and I thought I had community, I just took it for granted. And it wasn't community at all. And my home wasn't a home. It was a little stucco McMansion. And so in my 40s, I finally found those two things, and I feel very fortunate, very fortunate. So
you have to look.
I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
One quick stat I want to throw out, and with any stat I give you today, just recognize that my brain is terrible at holding on to stats. So I think I'll have this somewhat right, but I think it's 40% of Americans do not consider where they live home. And that is because we move for those careers. We move, you know, because we want to see if we can get promoted. Mm-hmm. That means 40% of us are in a place that doesn't feel like our home grounds, and that's a really sorry state to live in for your whole life.
Yeah, and most people that I know in my life live their entire lives that way. This is the first time in my life that I've ever come across a group of people, and a large group of people in this particular community, that really are committed to home and community. So,
and are living in a place on purpose, not because the job took them there.
Correct, which is a huge difference, right?
Yeah. So you suggested, yep, Sean, that in the West, as described by Abby and interpreted by you, the West is a state of mind as much as a geographical location. And I think that plays into this conversation about home. What do you mean? What do you think Abby meant? Well, that the West is a state of mind, not just geography.
Well, I believe what Abby meant, or at least my interpretation, and he's talking about everything west of the 100th meridian, is that once you get out further west, once you leave agriculture as the main economic, you know, determining factor, and go towards ranching more or to other industries or lack of industries, once you hit those mountains and those deserts, you get that you know, wilderness or wildness ethic that we see, because it's hard to live in those spaces. It's hard to live in the desert without much water, though obviously we're not too concerned with that in a lot of the cities of the Southwest. And it's hard to survive in those mountains. And because there's often smaller communities, because they're farther spread out from each other, there's this feeling of wildness, this feeling of isolation, this feeling of individual communities having individual identities, or individual people having individual identities. And you were talking about those McMansions, and we can find those McMansions everywhere, including in the West. But rather than having their own particular identity, I was in a big city not too long ago, and as I was walking through it, I was thinking, this city could be any city anywhere. And if you dropped me here and got rid of the one type of tree that distinguished it from everyone else, you'd have no idea where you're at. You know, suburbs are so often like that. But Abby felt that because the West was so underpopulated, because it was so wild, that place could be individual and people in that place could be individual. And then finally, the people in that place were affected intimately by that place.
Yeah, the West is a much different place than it was 48 years ago when Desert Solitaire came out. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No problem. Back then, Albuquerque, were at maybe 15 years before that, Albuquerque had 40,000 people. Right. And now the suburb outside of Albuquerque has 100,000 people, and Albuquerque has something like 800,000. So, yeah, the West is very different.
Yeah, and that was a place that when Abby got off the train there, that was the place that convinced him he needed to be in the West, the little cow town. In Albuquerque.
Yep.
I don't think you would say that today.
Oh, is this quaint?
Yep. Desert Solitaire was Abby's breakout book. It was pivotal for you as it was for me. It was published in 1968. It still has much to offer. Where would you start in describing what it has to offer you and others, particularly people who haven't read it yet?
It offers so many important things. One, and I briefly mentioned this earlier, is just the tone. I love Abby's tone, especially in his creative nonfiction, and how he's both a beautiful writer, but also how he's a human, and how he writes with humor, how he writes with anger, disgust. And, you know, that tone is not about his most important issues, but it allows the reader to just enter, at least a reader like me. So that's one thing, is I love how he writes words on the page. And I think so often we talk about Abby as a great environmental writer. And that's not always fair to him, because he's not just an environmental writer. He's a great writer. So that's part of it. The next part is, going along with that, he can take me to the desert. When I first read Desert Solitaire, I did not know the desert well. And Abby showed me spots in the desert that I'd never imagined existing. And because of that, he drove me out into the desert and got me to explore places I would have never gone before. And through those explorations, I ended up living in various parts in the desert Southwest. So Abby changed my life just by describing a place and making me care about it so much that I wanted to backpack through it, hike through it, and then later on move to it. And then the final thing is his environmental ideas. I was listening to NPR this morning, and they were talking, as we've been doing all year, about the 100th anniversary of the national parks. And back in the late 60s, Abby was talking about how we were going to destroy Arches National Monument as it was transitioning into becoming a national park. And Abby was recognizing how we're going to love our favorite places to death, and how we're going to turn those places into paved roads and parking lots. And you go to so many of the national parks, which I love, what you see is long lines of tourists wanting to see the beautiful sights. And Abby would yell at them. And I'll read a quick quote from Desert Solitaire, one of my favorite quotes. And he's talking about this idea of the industrialization of the national parks. And Abby says, and this is in Desert Solitaire, that you've got to get out of the car. And he says, walk, better yet, crawl on hands and knees over the sandstone and through the thorn bush and cactus. When traces of blood begin to mark your trail, you'll see something. Maybe. Probably not. And I love that quote, but the thing I love the most about it is what Abby's saying is that if we want to love a place, and we were talking about home earlier, if you want to consider it home, you can't just drive through it. You need to study it. You need to know it. You need to crawl on it until it physically, emotionally, mentally affects you. And again, I mean, it might be hidden underneath there, but Abby's talking about discovering home. And when we discover home, we care for it. And again, if you go back to that 40% of America that doesn't consider where they live home, that 40% is not going to protect where they're living, because they don't care about it. They don't value it. And we can see that in how America and how the world is treating our lands, whether it's public or private lands, for not thinking about how we can conserve or preserve this. We're thinking about how we can buy or sell it, how we can build upon it, how we can use it to move into the next house that also doesn't feel like a home. And I think those are some of the many, many ideas that Abby talks to us about in Desert Solitaire, and those are some of the ones that really moved me the most.
Yeah, those ideas resonate in Derek Jensen's writing as well, the idea of knowing a place, of getting familiar with the other organisms that you're sharing the land base with. And that will lead to the notion of protecting the space, of putting yourself out there to make sure that your neighbors aren't disappeared by civilization. You're listening to Nature Matters Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're engaged in conversation with Sean Prentice, author of Finding Abby. Sean, why don't you talk a little bit about Doug Peacock and his friendship with Edward Abby. 15 years apart in age, Doug Peacock was a little too old to have a father-son relationship with Abby, and they were too close in age, or rather too far apart in age, to have a sort of brotherly relationship. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll be talking, obviously, as a secondhand source. So this is how I perceive it, from talking to Peacock, from reading Abby's work. But exactly like you were talking about, you know, 15 years is quite a big difference, especially when I think Peacock was somewhere around, let's say, 35 years old when they first met. Right. And he's coming home from war, and he's dealing with the issues of war. And from everything I've read, he was living a very wild life on just about every single level. So his friendship with Abby was, you know, based around great ideas, big giant adventures, talking philosophy, but it was also built around, at least it seems, you know, maybe some short tempers, maybe some excessive drinking, those sort of things. So it seems like at times they were, you know, best friends, and at times they had pretty epic battles. And Peacock talked about one story where Abby encroached upon one of Peacock's ex-girlfriends a little too quickly, and it moved toward the edge of violence. And Peacock's like, I just told you to wait. Just wait a little bit. And so it seemed like they could push each other's buttons. But the big thing is, I mean, Abby's been dead since 1989, which is pretty long ago. And when I got a chance to talk with Peacock, he did talk about those issues because I asked about them. But what he really talked about was Abby's ideas, Abby's mind, Abby's passion, and their friendship. And he told these really funny, mundane stories of Abby and Peacock going trick-or-treating with their kids, and their kids would be in their costumes walking down the road, and Abby and Peacock would be in a pickup truck with their handguns underneath the seat and a beer can in each one of their hands, and there were being these strange mixes of iconic fathers going door-to-door with their kids, and also these wild Western men with, you know, beers and guns. And he told, you know, so many of these stories, and then the story of Abby's death and his burial, that were really much less focused on the cantankerousness of their friendship and more on, and I think, you know, distance and perspective will do this, on the joy of their friendship and what Abby taught Peacock, and obviously what Peacock also taught Abby.
Yeah, you know, you don't see relationships like that between men too often. I mean, these guys, you know, when everything from drinking beers and shooting guns, but at the end, you know, Ed's asking Doug questions like, how about that overdose? And asking him for, you know, where's that gun? And talking about his own death. And to have a relationship like that's that intimate at the end, most of us never have anything like that.
Especially between two sort of larger-than-life tough guys.
Right, your stereotypical kind of cut-from-granite kind of guys, right, yeah. That's what touched me about the relationship, you know, from what I read and spoke to Doug about.
I agree with you. I thought it was really beautiful. And when Abby was asking Doug for a very specific revolver, I think it was a revolver, or at least a handgun, that he wanted to use. And it was pretty clear he wanted to end his own life because he was suffering so much.
Yeah.
And Peacock could very easily have done it, said, yep, that's a masculine thing to do. Go out into the woods, find a spot. And Peacock was, you know, instead thinking about Abby's family, thinking about other times he'd experienced people who took their own lives, and he refused to do that. And he, you know, was coming over to articulate that to Abby when Abby finally took that last turn. And he was, you know, rather than being that masculine man, he was being a complex human, which is one of the many things I love about Peacock.
Yeah, the complexity, and he shows, you know, the struggle of you know, dealing with that particular situation, and you kind of put yourself in his shoes at times when you're reading it. You're like, I don't know what I would have done.
Right.
I mean, so.
Yeah.
All right, we
have
a caller. We have Ricky from Philadelphia. Ricky, you got a question?
Hey, good afternoon, guys. I have a question that relates to both today and really the three Corey Morningstar shows that you've done over the last 2 months or so. And going back to the clinical psychology episode from a couple weeks ago, and that is, I really, you know, even going beyond this sort of whole complex human versus masculine thing, I feel like when we have these discussions with people that aren't quite where we are at in this grieving process, that it's continually a trade-off between disseminating truthful information about how much our lifestyle really is hurting the climate and biosphere, and just, you know, versus lying to people. And so I was just kind of wondering, you know, and I feel like that's what 350.org and blue recycling containers do. You know, it's the drain to get rid of our guilt. It's a way for us, you know, to drain the guilt and not have to deal with any, you know, not any of the spiritual or mental consequences. So I guess my question really, you know, for, I guess, both of you, all of you, is, you know, is there a way to disseminate this information honestly and do it in a way where you can still, I'm not saying leave hope for people, but leave their mental well-being intact? Or is it just simply a trade-off exercise where you sort of have to choose between the two?
Okay, thanks for the question. Yeah. I think storytelling, I think Sean's book's an excellent example of this, is when we talk about this particular information, abrupt climate change and extinction events, near-term human extinction, things like that, it's tough to reach people and it's tough to connect with them if you're not doing it via a narrative. And so I think even reading stuff about people who have, you know, come before us, like Ed Abbey, really can change how we look at a particular place where we may have taken for granted, like I have, and like Sean has, and Guy has. We look at things being more home-like and community, and not just human community. And so I try and use a narrative, and I know Guy does as well, to not quite devastate people when you talk about these things, because all they're going to do is just shut down. And if you throw a lot of, you know, facts at them about, you know, ice melt and population growth, people just kind of curl up into a ball.
Yeah, their eyes glaze over.
Yeah,
and so that doesn't really reach anybody. So narrative, so storytelling is an art, obviously, not much of a science. And we can get across the scientific information using an artistic manner. When I first started speaking about near-term human extinction as a result of climate change, I was the medical doctor who came in, gave the news without making eye contact in 3 minutes, walked out and said, "Be sure to pay on the way out." It was completely heartless. You know, I have a golf game to go to next, so deal with the receptionist on your way out. So it took a while for me to become better at telling the story without completely ruining everybody's life, pointing out that our time here is short no matter how you deal with it, and so we might want to act accordingly.
Right.
Sean, I'm sure by this time you have some comments on this subject.
Well, first off, I thought both of what you said was perfect. I agree that almost always that story is going to help convey the idea. I teach a variety of writing classes, and one of them that I teach is professional writing. And it seems about as far away from what we're talking about as you can get, but I think if you just convey an idea without sandwiching it around a story, so often most of our audience doesn't get it. But then the other thing is to just think about audience, and each person's a little bit different, so I don't think there's a one-size-fit-all. For me, yeah. I need story, or I need to touch things and see things and experience things. But one of my students is an engineer, and we were talking about these ideas, and he said, "I like this story over here for the story, but I like this one even better because it's filled with ideas, and it went against everything I normally teach, but it reminds me of we have to think about who our audience is and how many different ways we can give it. So sometimes we got to have to give it in a negative way and show the horrors facing us. Other times in a more positive way, sometimes through ideas, sometimes through stories. And the more stories we can tell or the more ways we can tell it, the more people we can reach. And I think that's the key. Sometimes I'm going to tell you something and it's not going to work for you. So let me try another way and then another way and another way. And then maybe we'll get our message across."
Yeah, speaking of storytelling and words, and obviously Abby was a master wordsmith, can you talk a little bit about the difference between eco-sabotage and eco-terrorism, and maybe weave in a little bit about what your view of the future of environmental radicalism looks like?
Yeah, definitely. So Abby helped radicalize the environmental movement, and he coined the term monkey wrenching, which is a type of eco-sabotage. And the way he saw the two difference, the two being different, and I agree with him, is that eco-sabotage is where you attack the things that do the destruction, but never attack the humans, so you'll never cause loss of life to a human or hurt a human intentionally. Whereas eco-terrorism, you can attack the machines or the human, and either is fine. And now, today, we don't really use eco-sabotage. We love the term terrorism, so we just kind of call the people who are doing eco-sabotage, we call them eco-terrorists.
Right.
Which I don't think is fair at all. But then, in terms of radical environmentalism and where it might be headed, my thought is that eco-sabotage has its place, but the problem with it is that we're often just doing some small damage to some small thing, and it doesn't really lead to any major change unless so many of us are doing so much sabotage that we're constantly at war with these machines. The other part of the problem is, especially living in a time when this fear of terrorism is so high, if you do eco-sabotage, you're facing much greater risks than you used to in terms of penalties of law. So I think it's a lot harder to do eco-sabotage than it used to be. And I also think the world is changing. And for me, the new environmental radicalism, and it goes back to places, is how do we live like we used to? How do we live more locally? So I think CSAs are a type of environmental radicalism. And, you know, we're supporting our community agriculture. We're supporting our local stores that find goods and services near them. I think radical environmentalism is educating particularly our women of poverty so that we can, you know, reduce overpopulation issues throughout the world. And for me, it's that new way of creating people who are invested less in the economics and more in the place, and people who are willing to invest in that place, invest their time, their money, their ideas into creating local communities that are more self-sustainable. So those would be some of my ideas on where environmental radicalism is going. So it's kind of a misnomer. I mean, we're just traveling back to the ideas that sustained us for so many years.
Right.
To, you know, commit to place, to commit to one area, learn that area, and work with that area, which means recognizing when there's too many of us in a single area or on our entire earth.
Yeah, it seems to me, Sean, that even the word radical has been hijacked. You know, getting to the root is really what we're talking about here, and it has become more about extreme, you know, being an extremist, if somebody uses the word radical. And you're right. I think because we don't even know what the word means, we have no idea what something radical even looks like or what it requires. And in going back to living locally and living off, you know, what surrounds you, unfortunately, that's that's become the radical idea. And
yeah,
at this point, it's you know, we're kind of stuck because that's not necessarily going to save anything or us when you're adding 238,000 people to the planet every day, births minus deaths. We're kind of stuck, and you know, we've all grown up in this. We've all grown up domesticated and then indoctrinated, and some of us start to pull that particular string and kind of unwind a little bit, but we spend our entire lives doing it.
Right. Next thing you know, you start pulling that string, you're living in a tent.
Right. You live in a yurt, and you're talking to guys that write books about Abby.
But it's a hard move to do. I mean, we've been trained by education, trained by family, you know, just to disconnect from the land. And a quick example, my family moved to my hometown in Pennsylvania in the 1740s. So
wow.
I would have been, I think, the 11th generation in my hometown. But for about two of those generations, my family moved to the city to find work. And then when they came back, we had lost so much of our connection to the land. Right. We'd given up our agrarian roots. We had stopped hunting. And, you know, we still love that landscape, and I always will. But we became a new people, and we became outsiders to the land because we'd given it up to try to survive financially. And that changes everything. You lose all your history and your stories and your knowledge.
Yeah, your skill set can go like that. It's amazing. It really, one generation, and the skill set is gone.
And yep.
Right. I mean, kids who grew up on the farm, for example, and that's all they ever knew, mm-hmm. they have these skills they don't even know they know.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's just part of living. They get up, they do these certain things. They think everybody must be doing these same things.
Right. Yeah.
If only.
If only, yeah. But the rest of us are going to a place and somebody's giving us some money, and then we can go and have the guy unlock the food for us because we give him some paper.
Right.
But yeah.
So more about home. Can you talk a little bit about wilderness and wildness and the difference between them in the views of you and how you perceive Abby's views?
Yes, and they're complicated on a variety of levels, but Abby was a huge fan of wilderness. I think wilderness is a great thing. I think it's got its problems. The big problem is there's very few places on Earth that have been without humans. So now, because of our overpopulation issues, we're trying to protect our lands, which I think is great, but we're trying to protect them in non-realistic ways. And by protecting them, which, again, I love the idea of protecting our lands, and we need to protect them, but by removing most of humans from them, we're breaking those stories that we were just talking about. So we're disconnecting people from a lot of lands to protect these lands. So that gets complicated and confusing because I want to protect these lands, but I also want to make sure that, as we've always done, we have a connection to those lands. And then the next thing is, I think this idea of wildness is great, and how do we bring wild to a variety of places, including urban and suburban areas? So examples being inner city gardens, honeybees brought in as pollinators to the suburbs. All of these ideas are great, but the problem with it is we often use this idea of wildness as a crutch to not mind the devastation we're doing around those areas. So if I build a big, giant building and I put a garden on the top and I say it's a living roof and I'm creating my own food, then the building's okay. And I think a lot of times we're really short-sighted with that. And wildness is vital. But again, and I hate to keep talking about the same thing over and over again, no matter how much wildness we bring to urban areas, if we keep expanding our footprint, then that wildness becomes less and less valuable. And the wilderness becomes more and more encroached upon, and all we're doing is creating urban and suburban spots all around the globe. And it doesn't matter then about wildness or wilderness, we'll have gone too far. So we need wildness. We need, well, I don't know if we need wilderness, but we need a world in which the land can be wild in conjunction with humans. Yeah. But we have to just think about, it's those two, with overpopulation issues, with climate change issues, are not enough.
What if my building is LEED certified, like LEED platinum? Then it's okay, right?
Especially, yeah, I guess then you'll have solar. All these things are great. So, yeah, you've got it. Yeah, we've got to make it LEED certified with the living roof, and then everything's okay. I'm going to have my five kids, and we're good to go.
And don't forget to vote.
The right way.
The right way.
Mike and I were in the wilderness a couple of days ago. Mark made a short video clip of us talking about, you know, the idea of wilderness. We were in the world's first designated wilderness, the Gila, and talking about how this rock is in the wilderness, so we can't mess with this rock. And I mean, we were getting right at what you've just been talking about.
Yeah, the absurdity of it on some levels.
Yeah.
Is
yeah, it's ridiculous that we designate wilderness areas.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine 200 years ago?
Right.
The concept of wilderness areas?
It's a preserve. What are you preserving it from? Well, from us.
Yeah, because we're all bad people, apparently.
I was just reading this article that was talking about jaywalking and this idea that it's illegal to walk in certain ways.
Right.
And we could walk any way we wanted to until we invented the car and decided that the car has precedence. So now we humans have to figure out how to traverse a road that's legal. And it's the same thing with wilderness. At one point, there was no need for wilderness. And now there's at least a need to say, don't touch that rock over there.
Yeah, I was in Africa. I was in Uganda 5-6 years ago, and there was this small village we were in, and there was a speed bump about every 30 feet. And that was because we were told that when cars came, people kept getting hit because they couldn't judge the speed of the vehicle because they had never seen cars. So there's this idea of that, you know, people could they could walk anywhere they wanted to, but now you get some mechanism that could literally kill you. So it was an odd thing that, you know, cars had come to this village and they had to protect people by literally putting bumps in the road every so often. And it was just another example of sort of the insanity that is civilization.
But notice we don't question the cars.
Well, no.
I gotta get somewhere.
I gotta get a job. You know.
I've got a beautiful Toyota Tacoma that I'm gonna get in that gets probably 17 miles per gallon. So no, let's not question the cars.
Right.
So your book, Environmental and Nature Writer, a Craft Guide and Anthology, is due out later this year. Then what? What's next up for you after that?
Well, so the next project I'm working on is, I kind of conceive of it as part two to Finding Abby. So Finding Abby ends with me really reflecting on home and searching for a new home. And now once I've ended in northern Vermont, and this goes back to losing a history of a place. I'm trying to move to a new area and gather that history, which I should have been learning for all 43 years of my life, and now I'm starting so late. So this new book is about moving to northern Vermont and learning how to bow hunt with a new mentor named Uncle Bear. He's my wife's uncle, and he's teaching me how to bow hunt. And while he's teaching me how to bow hunt, he's also teaching me about Vermont and about our region. And it's about learning home. It's about food-related issues. It's about mentorship and just kind of reflecting on, and of course, bow hunting, and just reflecting on trying to be home in a place and learn that place. Because I spent my whole life traveling, and it sounds like you all both did a bunch of this, and I always loved visiting and learning, but I never got super intimate once I left my original home ground in Pennsylvania. So it's about learning home ground through a mentorship of bow hunting. So that's the idea.
Right on. Well, we look forward to it, and please let us know when it's out. We'll go from there. We appreciate, we're out of time, Sean, but we appreciate your work and your voice, and thank you so much for coming on.
Mike and Guy, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a great conversation with you two.
All right, thank you. You've been listening to Finding Abby, A Search for Edward Abbey and His Hidden Desert Grave by Sean Prentice. Guy, you got a climate update?
I do, just a brief one today. A study published in the April 18th, 2016 online issue of Nature Geoscience indicates a strong contribution of freshwater and terrestrial carbon to acidification of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. The study includes Igor Samelatov and Natalia Shakova as co-authors, and it indicates the interaction among the self-reinforcing feedback loops of freshwater melt, permafrost, and ocean acidification. Observations made since 1999 indicate that in some locations, acidity has already surged past levels researchers didn't expect to emerge until the year 2100, due in part to extreme aragonite undersaturation.
In other words,
aragonite is a form of calcium carbonate that is pervasive in the ocean. It tilts ocean geochemistry towards the base level of the pH scale. Carbon in the water tilts the pH scale towards the acid level. The degree to which the water is saturated with aragonite is a marker of overall calcium levels and a marker of acidification caused by increasing loads of carbon in the water. So carbon in the water, bad for ocean acidification.
You should have just said that.
Okay, that would have saved a minute right there.
Right.
A final note from me regarding my upcoming speaking tour in California. There will be a potluck dinner on May 1st in the East Bay for details. send an email message to info@guymcphersontour.com. I'd love to meet listeners in person. So I look forward to seeing you in the East Bay area.
All right. That about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Laughs and Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Laughs on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. And please share the link widely. And continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. You can follow my work at michaelsleva.wordpress.com. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll chat with independent journalist Corey Morningstar about the celebrity culture and its misguided feel-good approach towards, quote-unquote, fixing climate change. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM, Stitcher.com, or rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners and for Sean Prentice and Afrozen for his music and our live studio audience and Mark for filming. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature bats last.
Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you.